necklace of primordial mind. That is, every one of these lives, although appearing separate, was arising from primordial mind. It was apparently separate life, but in this dream kind vista, it wasn't separate. There was only one life. There was only one mind. There was only this one primordial being, and it put on different clothes from time to time in the apparent world. So this is the way that the idea of a deeper anamnesis is not just to go life to life to life, but to go to source. You see, when people play the past life game, I was a this, I was a that, you were a this, very rarely do they go back to source. And that's the root. The final anamnesis is back to source, to emptiness itself, to source, to God, to over-self, whatever you want to call it. And this is anamnesis depth, as opposed to, and it's a type of cross-state retention to source, as opposed to associative cross-state retention extended-wise. So you go to depth, and you go to breadth. Now these two things will trigger each other off. You see, what constantly goes through my head, I'll look at things in breadth. The mind will go, da-da-da-da, this relates to this, and this relates to this, and this relates to this. It always happens, funny enough, many times when I'm walking by a big apartment building in a city or something. You look at a room, a window, an arbitrary window, and you know that somewhere in that apartment a drama is going on, a life drama is going on in that apartment. And you realize in that apartment there's another drama, in this apartment, and every one of it, there's millions of dramas going on. And you speed up the mind a billionfold to all the dramas that are going on the face of the earth until you go like that, and you put them, then you collapse the wavefront, as it were, into just an instant. And you realize that, yes, they're all going on, but it's all now as well. It's not just the extension, but it's the collapse of the extension into the primordial moment. And it's that oscillation between the extension of this glass bead game type of thinking. And you go on, you see, it could go on forever, in infinity. But you have to go back to its source as well, which stops everything in a moment. And then there's this vast sense of interrelatedness. And these two things have to properly interact with each other in a kind of a mystical framework. If you get stuck just on the proliferation, you'll go crazy. If you get stuck just on the primordial now, you'll kind of, this is what they call dead void heretics in the Zen tradition. You just become, I'm deeply in the void, don't bother me, you know, just leave me alone and let me sit. So you have to be able to go from these two kind of states. And that's that dance, that oscillation, which is really key. Now, other ways in which we tend to miss out on cross-state retention in our 20th century life is the idea of the elimination of rites of passage, any types of rites of passage from childhood to adolescence to manhood. I mean, the vestiges that we have left don't really do the job in our culture. Rites of passage are more seen on what kind of salary you're getting. You know, that this is a big rite of passage. Marriage, on the whole, so many marriages aren't conscious marriages. So many children, I mentioned this to Jill yesterday, so many children that are born maybe are not consciously, you know, looked at as a process of birth. But rite of passage is a way of going from one state to another state. And if you don't have that awareness built into your culture, you lose. You lose the dissipative cycle. You lose the big mind picture at that point. So that is an important thing. Another aspect about cross-state retention is the idea of that transitions, that's why I said reversals, they encourage cross-state retention. The solstices and the equinoxes, for example, are points of temporal transition from balances of night and darkness. And these points of transition are ideal times to plant a seed in the mind to say, remember now, at this axis of time, this nexus of time, really remember what you're all about in the cycle. Because every solstice and equinox is a point on the dissipative cycle of the year. And you should use these axis points, these kind of focal points, as points to plant suggestions for integration into the environment, to make the environment conscious, as it were. What we have to become, then, in a sense, is what I would call psychic amphibians, We have to be, you see, an amphibian is some, an animal or a being that can go from water to land. It's a cross-state animal, you see. So we have to become kind of psychic amphibians, in a sense. And this will really begin to get us into the mode of cross-state retention. Cross-state retention would, if taught in this kind of way, would have a tremendous kind of revolution in education, which I want to mention at the very end here. Now, one last thing on cross-state retention is the, two. There is the, first of all, the idea of, in Jung's theory of synchronicity. That's very interesting. He says, in synchronicity, we have two types of temporal events. One occurs on a sequential chain. This happens, and as a consequence, this happens, and as a consequence, this happens. Primary, secondary, tertiary effects. Then he says, on the other hand, there may be a kind of meaningful cross connection. Now, it's this, from this idea of cross connection that, incidentally, that he borrowed from Schopenhauer, from an essay called On the Apparent Design and the Fate of the Individual. And interesting analogy there, Schopenhauer took a world globe model, and he took the meridians of the model to be the causal chains of events. But the parallels, he said, these were the cross connections that happened in life. And this is how Jung built his theory of synchronicity from this geographical analogy of Schopenhauer's. Now, it's interesting that synchronicity means the simultaneous occurrence of a psychic state, an internal psychic state, and a corresponding external event occurs, which kind of mirrors or cross-connects to this state, you see. So in the idea of synchronicity, we get we don't get a temporal density. We get a temporal fluidity begins to occur at this time. And this is where magical thinking is born. This is where all the magical memory systems like Bruno's magical memory system take their heart out. This kind of correspondence between all these symbolic objects and the corresponding psychic states that go with them. Now, the last method in this framework, all aspects of divination. Divination is like throwing the I Ching, reading coffee leaves, throwing coca leaves, reading the oracle bones, looking at clouds, reading the flight of birds. These are all processes of divination. Divination means to become godly or have a godly insight, a godly knowledge into something. Now, the essence of all divination is to connect the unconscious to the conscious. It is a cross-state bridge. That's what it's about. When you divine something, so that you throw a mo in the Tibetan tradition, you throw the cards, you read the tarot, whatever it is. It's a cross-state. You're using these symbols, you're using this as a medium, as it were, to go from the unconscious to the conscious, and to facilitate this kind of cross-state communication. And when I say cross-state, it has the implication of extended communication, or of an extended mind concept, goes with the idea of cross-connection. Now, finally, in this, to bring it down to a literal sense in the this whole kind of cross paradigm. Incidentally, one of the great general systems theorists, James Miller, a biologist, talks about, he said, there are many people who do systems analysis. That is to say, you take a business and you analyze how it works, every little bit of it. He said, but the much deeper way to operate is what he calls the cross-level hypothesis. When you begin to mix things from different levels, symbolic levels. On a mundane term, what's going on with athletics and aerobic and aerobics and fitness is rather interesting, because there is a new type of training going on now, and this new type of training is called cross training. It's called cross training. There's a lot of people going to triathletes, the Ironman stuff, where you swim and then you run and then you bicycle. And what people are doing, I'm reading from an article, it says, first associated with triathletes who needed to be prepared for running, swimming, and biking, cross-training has been adopted by other athletes, and now the general public. Skiers are alternately roller skating, lifting weights, and running before the first snow falls. Runners are swimming and doing low-impact aerobic dancing. And in the same way, beginning exercises are swimming, riding stationary bikes, or taking stretching classes, etc. But what it does is interesting. Cross-training appears to cut down injuries because various muscle groups are strengthened by the different forms of exercise. So you see, I'm making the analogy between physical cross-training and psychic cross-training. You exercise different, as it were, psychic muscles by this kind of cross-state interest. Finally, an obvious way of inducing cross-state memory and perception is to be taught in a way in school or in education, which the very last thing I'll say is going to focus on that. Now, one last subject before the final last subject. This one won't be that long. There is a great thinker that I would like to honor for a moment in the general systems theory framework. It's someone that I knew personally, and I know that Terence knew, and that's Eric Jantsch. And Jantsch was a mathematician and a musician and a systems man in every dimension. His works are like, they're kind of like the glass bead game in a certain sense. They roam in so many different arenas. And I talked to him about, you know, my work and thesis and stuff like that on several occasions. And there's a term of his which caught my eye, which I would like to bring to front now, which I have found to be, along with the non-memory concept in my thesis, one of the central things that I'm going to be using. And that is what he calls holistic system memory, HSM, holistic system memory. And essentially, he remarks here, he says, in evolving systems, or systems with history, that is to say, all dissipative systems, each system state depends on the past development of all subsystems. There exists, therefore, a system memory in terms of the entire system. In other words, there is some system memory, no matter what phase you're in of the dissipative cycle, whether it's arising, abiding, or dissolving, there is some holistic system memory which has got all the pieces, no matter which phase you're in. There's something which has got it all. It's the way I can put it. Call it an overmind, if you will, for easy visualization. So this holistic system memory, he goes on to say, each system with history, that is, dissipative system, remembers the total development itself of its whole. In other words, its anamnesis, its karmic trajectory, and is therefore capable of what he calls religio, with its own origin. Now the word religio is from religion. Religion, it means to reconnect with, really to reconnect with the source, is its original intent. So a holistic system memory operates by reconnecting to the source of the system. So with that in mind, I'd like to just look at a very interesting dynamic here. What it means is you start from this, say, this is point A. You start here. Now, by reconnecting to your source, it means you go backwards to your source. That means backwards to your, like Buddha's, the emptiness at the end of all those lives, the source, the primordial mind. You're back to that point. Now, at this point, a curious thing happened, and it happened to Buddha as well. After you go back to source, you get a feed forwards into the future of an unexpected, unanticipated range of insight. But you have to go back to ground zero in order to go forward. It's the old French reculer pour mieux sauter. You draw back to leap forward. Now, this model I have found operative in so many different forms, in shamanic ecstasies, in psychoanalysis, in personal insight and creativity. It is this idea of going back to source, this temporary suspension of non-memory, you see, and then there can be a leap forward. But there has to be a prepared mind before you go back to source. Many people just think, oh, I'll be quiet and I'll get creative. First, you have to fill the mind with intense creativity in terms of a search. There has to be this intent. Then you have to release totally, and you go back. Now, this idea of holistic system memory incorporates then both the idea of, shall we say, cross-state retention at the beginning, going back to non-memory, and then you get this leap into the unknown, which takes you to some other cross-state insight. But it's a I'm doing it very succinctly here because it's a subject which I could take a lot more time with, but I just wanted to give you a flavor of this. It's like in shamanic tradition, it's the idea of a shaman takes a psychedelic, for example, and then goes through a state of dismemberment. The idea of the body is seen to be dismembered by some spirit animal, for example, eaten by a great bear or an eagle or a jaguar or what have you. And then it goes back to, as it were, you see, this dismemberment takes you to ground zero. You go back to source, to where the allies, the spirits, can take you and remake you. And then they throw you into the future like that, and you fly on the wings of the unknown, and you come back with this gift from the unknown at that point. But you have to go through the dismemberment before the rememberment of the psyche. There is that kind of cycle. And it's interesting that in many of the Greek myths, for example, in one of the Greek myths of the 6th century B.C., there is a cave in Greece called Trophonius, the cave of Trophonius. Trophonius was the god of dreams and sleep. But you would go into this cave, and you would first sit on what they call the chair of forgetting, the chair of Lethe. And this chair of Lethe, as it were, you were given what I reckon to be a psychomimetic mushroom brew. And then you were, after this took effect, then you were placed on another chair called the chair of memory. And after you were wiped clean of your from the chair of forgetting of who you were dismembered psychically through the psychedelic, then you sat on this chair of remembering, and the new information came through you. Now, again, this is the same way that the cloud of unknowing works. You have to unknow before you come to God. You have to dismantle all your names, labels, places, categories, and concepts. And only through unknowing can you be filled with a different spirit, the spirit of God. So, but you have to release first. Now, this idea of holistic system memory is quite a key one. I really haven't done it justice now, but in a re-education process, and that's the last thing I want to spend a few minutes on, it is where I would put a lot of emphasis. You see, the way that our memory works today, we spend a lot of time exercising rote mnemonics in terms of, you know, like all these memory systems are based on win friends and influence people by this fabulous memory system and all this type of thing. But that's quantitative memory. It has nothing to do with quality of memory. Quality of memory has to do with being able to touch source, being able to touch origin, and then this leap of the unknown out of it. I would like to see in some type of educational situation for children, I'm really talking about, I've taught at university level, and I've taught at adult education level. The area that interests me the most now is at the children level, because I cannot see the sense of going 20 years and then telling a kid, look, you got it all wrong, you're neurotic, we're going to have to send you to a psychoanalyst, and to de-school someone after 20 years. I can't see the sense of it. It's totally counterproductive. If you give someone an education which is cross-state or extended to begin with, that is to say, you are taught a good cross-state analogy is the glass bead game, in a sense. You see the relationship of a volcano to a symphony to a star, and you begin to extend the mind through all these different categories. You don't just teach children state specifically. This is mathematics, and this is history, and this is biology, and you never teach how they cross. You never look at the parallels in the analogy of the globe. So this is what I would really emphasize in education. And I would also educate in terms of senses, as I've said before here. I really think you have to take each sense, and you have to teach each sense in detail. You want a master of each sense. You want a master of sight, smell, touch, hearing, sound, etc. All of the senses, a master, for the kids to be taught sequentially by each one of these. And then you teach them, after the sequential thing, how to integrate all these different masteries of the senses. And then you will get cross-state perception, And when you get cross-state perception, you will get cross-state retention. That's really, in a nutshell, how it works. Now, one of the things in the way that we're kind of exposed to life and consciousness in terms today, is we are, every technology, as McLuhan says, and I'll quote him, the main influence of any technology is not exercised consciously through concepts and opinions, but rather unconsciously by altering the sense ratios of patterns of perception. You see, it's not just the technology. The technology alters our sense ratios. And our sense ratios have been pushed so that the visual thing is where it's at. And I have nothing against vision per se, but I'm just saying the sense of all the other senses are secondary to vision. It's 70 to 80% of the way we sense the world. If another opportunity arises, I'll share with you, or I have with many of you before, my interest in the sense of smell, I think, is another thing that could be emphasized very strongly. So we have to learn how to get our way out of this, what I call sensory amnesia, which we really have for many of the senses. Now, the idea of, as I said, this kind of cross-state amphibians is a very, very important one. And I think that we have to learn in being cross-state amphibians, and from the altered state experience, one of the biggest things that I've ever learned is, as I was trying to say, to point out last night in my question to Terrence, you know, so many people can't bring it back alive. It's just, they know they had the feeling, that limbic flash of emotional, yeah, I got it, aha, rush. But they really don't have the content. And the trick, you see, is the following that I found after my own voyages into these realms, is to learn to pay attention while you are in the state of what is going on to a very precise degree. In other words, to imprint at the moment of recognition a moment which says, aha, this is how it works. I see this goes to move to this. This is important. I will put a beacon in my mind at this point. I will light a bonfire so that later tomorrow when I wake up, I will see that bonfire in my mind. And that bonfire will remind me of that insight, that beacon. You see, what you're doing, as one teacher, E.J. Gold, one of the workers and the good chief workers, said, what you're doing is you're building beachheads in the fourth dimension by this technique. What you're essentially doing is you are learning to imprint your attention, your intention to remember at the moment of recognition. You have to imprint that intention to hold. It isn't enough just to have it. You know, as you said before, it's not enough just to, how did you say, you've got to face the thing that's already there, in a sense. It's not just a question of confronting something else. And this idea of imprinting at the moment, because you see, these ideas that we have in altered states, I'll put it very graphically, have an extremely short half-life. They go like that, like that, like that, like that. And they're coming all over the place, especially when time becomes liquid. They come at you from omnidirectional. As Terrence said, you're dealing with hyperdimensional idea complexes. And the way that, if you cannot imprint this will, this intention to recall in the ordinary state, you lose it. Now, the way that my mind works in these states, in this kind of extended runs, my mind works in these kind of bifurcations. One thing reminds me of another thing reminds me of another, and da-da-da-da-da. But unless I make a moment for recapitulation while I'm in the state, I'll lose it. You have to be able to do that, even for a microsecond, or else you lose it. You see, because what it is attention. You are investing some more attention at that moment into the idea. So attention is the way that you can develop your cross-state retention, is the development of attention. Really develop that sense of attention. Anyhow, in summing all this up, for the idea of an extended mind is this idea of going cross-state is extending. But to do that, you have to learn the simple art of attention, and you have to realize that objects are attention traps if you are unconscious, and they will fixate your attention and trap them. You will be hooked into what happens to your Mercedes. or what happens to your beautiful house if you let yourself go to that extent. Conversely, you shouldn't pay, you know, no attention to them at all. There has to be a balance between paying too much and too little attention. There has to be that kind of sense of right effort of attention. But this idea of an extended paradigm, I think, going over the idea of the object proliferation and the attention and the cross-state retention, are different ways that I can see that kind of contribute to this this overall idea of an extended mind paradigm. So I'm going to shut up now. And I'd like to, if you have any questions or discussion or something like that, you know, go over some of these things.
The trick that I use is when something happens that I want to remember, I imprint it, as John said. But then 10 minutes later, I tell it to myself again.
Mm, yes.
And 40 minutes after that. You cannot simply mark it in your mind and 24 hours expect
to go back to it.
You have to hand it from the deeper levels to the slightly less deep levels to the more shallow levels and finally into consciousness. And this doesn't fail. If you do that, you'll get it out.
Yeah, that, this is a, it's a good point. It's called rehearsal.
Yeah.
And it's a, it is a way of memory transfer. Yeah, good point.
I was very interested by the way in which the themes that you, two of the themes that are striking me a lot in the course of these discussions are the habit versus novelty dichotomy. And morphic resonance is a system of habit formation and habit reinforcement. Terence's novelty wave running through history, the opposite of it, as novelty increases, one way of looking at what it is that decreases is habit, and as novelty decreases, what increases habit. So one can see the novelty wave as a kind of interplay of habit and novelty. And I thought that you took this, for me anyway, you took, suggested several new aspects of this way of looking at things, because through the loss of short-term memory, which you say precedes many altered states, and which is also surely a characteristic of dreams, it means that you're permanently, as it were, surfing on the advancing novelty wave. So you're, you know, what happened, you keep forgetting what's happened, and any object that's there now in the present can turn into something else, because there's sort of no habitual inertia. And this also is like the kind of Terence's theory of the origin of language that he told us last night, where people sort of babble in a kind of xeno-glossy way, sort of surfing on the breaking wave of novelty the whole time, and somehow transmitting that to others. But without the language yet having a whole series of built-up and established habitual meanings and conventions. And it seemed to me that your notion of cross-state retention is really, it's partly building up fields which embrace and, it seemed to me implicit in all you were saying, and sometimes explicit, as a kind of hierarchical field model of these things. So what you call, or what Jensch called, holistic systems memory would happen when you have a large-scale field with other subsystems within it, each with their own fields. And that even if individual systems come into being and pass away, the larger field somehow retains a memory of them. And the primordial mind could perhaps be considered the ultimate larger field within which all fields come into being and pass away. So it seemed to me to play to fit quite well with the sort of habit view and the proliferation of objects, which give us the ultimate sense of habit, because in a sense the solid state of matter, which is what most of our objects are made out of, iron, metal, originally stone, but then these other things derived from the earth and from rocks, like steel and aluminium and so forth. Solid objects, like rocks, from which they're derived, endure for extremely long time. Matter in the solid form is at its most fixed and habitual, less fixed in the liquid form, less still in the gaseous, and as a fluid plasma, there's a total flux the whole time. But in the solid form, in the crystalline form, in other words, it takes on a particularly rigid set of habits. And I think one of the ways that we think about reality depends on what we take as the basic paradigm for reality. And I think there's no doubt that solid objects are the basic paradigm for mechanistic science, because solid matter, the atoms, are considered the ultimate small solid objects. They're impenetrable. I mean, talking about the old style atoms of atomism, as of course atoms have turned out not to be like this at all, but the way they were thought of was as enduring solid objects. And I think that astronomy had a lot to do with that, because the astronomical model of reality is that the sun and the moon and things endure indefinitely, that when they disappear below the horizon, they haven't vanished. They're enduring in where we can't see them, that these solid objects persist indefinitely. And we live in a world which is conditioned by solid objects persisting for millions of years, far beyond human time spans. So we have the idea of astronomical time, and a kind of solid object paradigm, both of long-term time and of the endurance of objects in this world, which is very different from the biological paradigm of reality, which I suspect is, well, I'm fairly sure is Terence's leading one, and to a large extent my own, which the biological model is that, and the model you brought out, is that things come into being, they stay around, they stay for a while, or develop for a while, and they pass away. This is the biological model. Seeds germinate, plants grow, and they die. Babies are conceived, they grow as embryos, they're born, and people grow up and grow old, and they die. And this is true of all things in the biological realm. They come into being, and they pass away. What we have now is a model of the universe, where a biological model of the universe, an evolutionary universe, where the universe comes into being, the hatching of the cosmic egg, or the Big Bang, it grows and expands, and may, in due course, die, or come to some kind of culmination or transition. But that isn't the model that either astronomy gives us or mechanistic physics, which is based on eternal laws and eternal matter. There isn't this perpetual flux of growing, coming to being and passing away. And if we have a biological model, then that fits with both what you said about memory arising and persisting and falling back into non-memory, and fits into what something Terence said very evocatively last night, was this kind of whole biological psychedelic reality behind world of dreams, which is behind the world, the physical world, in which all of which things are coming into being and enduring and passing away. And things that come into being repeatedly become increasingly habitual. And things that, if we make an abstraction from the most habitual of things, namely crystals, we arrive at the idea of permanently enduring matter as the basic reality, rather than the coming into being of forms and patterns and their passing away and their recurrence.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting what you said about the proliferation of objects causing the increasing densification of the temporal dimension. It seems to me that, and I was saying this to Rupert at the break, that it's almost as though there is a transcendental object at the end of time, and that every object that is created is an effort to approximate the felt presence of the transcendental object, so that either, and I wondered as you spoke if perhaps we haven't passed the apex of the object proliferation phenomenon, perhaps around 1900 or so, and that now there actually are fewer and fewer objects in our lives as computers and things like that become multipurpose objects that combine in themselves or objectify in themselves the ability to be many, many different kinds of objects. And in a kind of millenarian extrapolation of that, I can see objects as part of the historical advance, objects beginning to be fewer and fewer. It's a kind of aesthetic taking hold, with the ultimate result being the presence of only a single object in the world. And that object would be the concrescent and objectified mind of the species, because every object is essentially a trap for mind, a frozen portion of the mental universe, so that one can... And it fails always because it's only an approximation of the perfect object. But this kind of idea ties in with the notion of the flying saucer. The flying saucer, which haunts time like a ghost, has a curious relationship to an axe head. It is, in fact, probably a manifestation of the same thing, so that we can see that mind is trying to manifest itself wholly and completely, and a notion like the philosopher's stone is a notion, a curious blending of mental and physical qualities, where something behaves like an idea but is made of matter and has the enduring qualities of matter but the transforming qualities of thought. So I guess what I'm saying is I think that we could almost measure our distance from the transcendental object at the end of time by the proliferation of objects in our mutually created world. And so that was very useful, that connection of objects to the density of time, to my own notion of a transcendental object, which is drawing things through time toward us. It can be extrapolated further. I mean, it's not only that all objects are attempts to realize the immanence of the felt object at the end of time, but all messiahs are trying to be the messiah. Religions are trying to be the religion. It's that what being in history is, it seems to me, is a series of attempts to approximate transcendental objects that are felt to be outside of time. And of course, memory is very important in this.
Mm. The symbol of the fascination. The fascination with crystals seems to me to be a signature of this theme, that we're the crystal is the diamond body, which is the ultimately enduring, ultimately transparent jewel, which lures us onwards to supreme order and matter, which once chaotic is in its state of supreme order, is ultimately luminous and transparent.
So that would view the current interest in crystals as a kind of symbolic fascination. This is my position.
Yes.
Glad that I didn't say it. Yes, I think you're right. That why the crystals are fascinating is not for any imagined power that they possess, but because they are the embodiment of an ideal, quite obviously.
See, this is what I meant before, and just about I've got this thing here, John, about impregnating conscious objects in the environment, and crystals would definitely be the primary aspect of a conscious object. You're taught that they can heal and respond to consciousness and stuff like that. So it's a very good specific example of a conscious environment. And I think you're somewhat optimistic to think we pass the apex. I think that we will pass it only to the degree that we go through some kind of very large scale bifurcation point. There's going to be some radical change. I don't think it's just going to be, okay, everybody, let's get rid of all your objects. Obviously, it's not going to be like that. I think the computer can save a lot of, as you say, multi-purpose work and tasks, but you see, capitalism as it stands now is based on the generation of objects.
Consumer
and
fetish.
That's what I mean. And so everyone wants to make that buck because you only go around once in life. You see, the point is, once we get rid of that you only go around once in life scenario, then the object proliferation will begin to diminish, because then you'll have a dream time kind of consciousness. And if you can have an electronic dream time, this was something that Andrew's talking about, you can begin to do that by using a computer, type of reality, as it were.
Well, don't you think maybe the hopeful sign is that though we don't necessarily follow it in our daily lives, that the dominant, I believe I can say this, I'm not sure, that the dominant aesthetic in the West is an anti-clutter. We really appreciate vast empty spaces and clean lines and white walls and receding perspectives, where our Victorian grandmothers, you know, liked to hang plants in small gloomy rooms with tables covered with tchotchkes and...
I'd agree, but by the same token, I think that a lot of the architecture is actually impoverished today. You look at the same street corner in Paris and 100 years ago and today, and you see what's there, and these clean, streamlined lines don't have the elegance. They don't have the beautiful curvilinear sense that represents the arising and dissolving aspect. I know what you want to say, but I can't go completely the idea that we want to be anti-clutter, because I find more, and I find that clutter is proliferating itself. I wish I could say that it was going the other way, where the awareness of clutter is here, yes. But I don't find you take a culture like Morocco or American Indian culture, where you have this beauty, you have a teepee or you have a mosque, or, you know, you have beautiful, simple, curvilinear lines and not too many objects. I don't know, I think we've got a ways to go before we reach that aesthetic. How many people here?
Here, the Japanese
That's
are rather
what
interesting, because they are the masters of space,
yeah.
The masters of no clutter, and objects for them have always been very few, and each material has been understood in its very essence, and that essence has become the object in all its manifestations. But now they're in this extraordinary role of providing us, of feeding the West with every kind of electronic object.
Yeah, and there's always new desires. For instance, I was thinking of like simple things like coffee makers, you know, that it's not a few years ago it was a big innovation to have like a drip coffee, Mr. Coffee kind of thing, but now you have to have an espresso machine, and then you have to have the thing with the steamer, you know, and it's not enough just to have a TV, you have to have a VCR, and then you have to have a special timing device that will catch your show when you're not home and play it back, and you have to have a pasta maker, and on, all these things. It's like, I see that it is proliferating, but I think what you might be talking about is that it's miniaturizing. The technology is getting smaller in a sense, but it's not particularly less objects. And the other thing I thought of when you were saying that was the movie 2001, where that whole theme of the object, actually the tool, is so explicitly stated, where the ape is with the bone hitting the first tool, and he throws it up in the air in ecstasy, and it comes down as this spaceship. And in a sense, HAL 9000 is that ultimate tool, and that's one of the main subplots of that movie, that it does do everything that you want an object to do, that it in some sense does approximate this omnipotent power, but something goes wrong and goes haywire.
Well, the curious thing about these lines of progression as they now surface in the computer industry is that the product which the computer industry is dealing is the self. That's what they're selling. And so aren't you interested in buying in to the self? How can you be without it? It's the ultimate product. I mean, they say you will be more powerful. Your memory, your plans, your wishes, your intentions. They have, out of dealing us all kinds of garbage, they have finally centered in on the ultimate product, the thing that everybody wants as much of as they can possibly get their hands on, and they're just packaging it up furiously and getting it out to us. But perhaps we've closed some sort of cycle with the realization that the ultimate product can be the self. Now let's just make that conscious, get money out of the cycle, and suddenly we will turn into a very different kind of civilization.
The other thing I was thinking about in there is Terence, when I visited him, recommended this book called Neuromancer, which basically, to follow that proliferation of objects into a fused whole, what this then posits is a not-too-distant future reality where there's a collective consensual reality called cyberspace. In other words, the computer opens out this consensual hallucinogenic reality that you then enter into, I'm not sure I want to go with that, except that that does become, that is a sense an object, but then that also in a sense becomes a state of consciousness as well. And it's a form of an extended mind that everybody shares in.
Yes, computers then become doorways rather than machines. I don't know how many of you have used the Macintosh operating system, but the genius of this operating system is, let's say you're in a program like Full Paint and you need a pencil, you must go and to this thing called the toolbox and get the pencil and bring it back to the desktop and then use it. And when you're through using the pencil, you put the pencil away. So all these conventions of ordinary three-dimensional space have been written into this operating system. So you need know nothing about computers. The computer has disappeared, and the ordinary set of reflexes, go get, pick up, use, put back, are all operating. And you can see in 20 years what this is going to lead to. It's going to lead to these are walk-in worlds that will be made as much as user-friendly as three-dimensional space. That's the goal, obviously, conceivably.
But it seems to me that object is very, I mean, it's a particularly materialized aspect of something that seems to obtain in every realm of reality. Because one, my experience of psychedelic realms is one of a wild proliferation of forms and shapes and patterns, and a limitless proliferation.
Sorry.
And biological evolution shows the same kind of seemingly limitless proliferation in over a million species of insects and tropical rainforests with tens of thousands of plant species in them. I mean, there's just this kind of wild proliferation which presumably happens when the novelty wave gets loose for a while, as it does again on Monday. This wild proliferation seems to be part of the very nature of things. And the thing about habit is that at least it has a kind of stabilizing effect on some of these proliferations. I mean, why should one want to bring anything back from a psychedelic experience or even from the Amazon jungle? And in a sense, you know... When one's got it back, it becomes a kind of object, a herbarium specimen, it has a name, it's sort of, it becomes part of the kind of objectified, materialized world. But one of the things that overwhelms me a lot of the time, it's a kind of feeling that I find hard to put to words, is just the overwhelming variety of objects. The fact one could, if one wished, pay attention to almost anything. When I was in India, I was employed to work on the physiology of pigeon pea plants, which are very much to my taste. They're a plant my own size, and I like them very much. And I know them better than any other plant, I think. But in a sense, there's infinite levels. You know, the anatomy of the pigeon pea, I know you can cut open any leaf or stem and put it under a microscope and see layers of cells and order within cells. And then there are thousands of varieties of pigeon pea plants. We had them growing in our fields. And there's thousands of different things you could look at in each variety and thousands of measurements you could make in these experiments. And that's just one plant within a genus which has something like 20 other species. And that's part of a family with thousands of other species within it. It seemed quite arbitrary. I could equally well, if somebody had asked me to, have been working on another plant in the species. There's this kind of arbitrary element to attention. And the same with books. You go into a library and there are thousands and thousands of books, or a bookshop, all on potentially fascinating topics. And you know, why should one read one rather than another? And that seems to be the big problem. If one is going to try and make cross-state pretensions, or if one is going to try and bring things back, why that rather than something else? Because we live in this wildly proliferating world.
Well, that's a good question. What? You know, why that rather than something else? I think the whole thing hinges on how meaningful it is at the moment to the person. Meaning is in the eye of the beholder. And if what, you know, something that is hyperdimensional to Terence or myself might be different to anyone else here. But the point is, usually, as you go up the node in these kind of hyperdimensional complexes, the ones up high, those are the ones, when you bring them back, are going to have the most extensive communicable aspect to all people at the most basic level. You see, if you pick from too low a level, you'll only be able to communicate to a super specialist. But you want to get those ideas of ultimate generalization, yet ultimate simplicity and ultimate power. And those are the ones, those are the rare animals, the rare plants, that when you bring them back, you can say something to a few people, and they don't have to have great training. They'll have the most impact. I think that's what it's about, the highest communicability. Kind of hyperdimensional complexes, the ones up high, the one, those are the ones, when you bring them back, are going to have the most extensive communicable aspect to all people at the most basic level. You see, if you pick from too low a level, you'll only be able to communicate to a super specialist. But you want to get those ideas of ultimate generalization, yet ultimate simplicity and ultimate power. And those are the ones, those are the rare animals, the rare plants, that when you bring them back, you can say something to a few people, and they don't have to have great training. They'll have the most impact. I think that's what it's about, the highest communicability.
Yes. Of course, Terence is on to a rather simple topic, in a sense, because if every one of the tropical species of the Amazon took one into a totally different psychedelic realm, it would be a kind of arbitrary quality. There does seem to be a manageably small number of known hallucinogenic plants.
Although not a manageable number of hallucinogenic images.
No. But there's a manageable number of hallucinogenic creodes.
That's true.
And in a sense, anyone who has the DMT experience and the mushroom experience is traversing a path, or at least they're going on a kind, they're getting a ticket to a realm. You know, they're checking in to a flight to a realm where others have been before. And
phenomenal on the proliferation of language. Mm-hmm. For instance, as we go back in time, the tools get simpler and simpler. Throw it, do all these things, but you notice that it could do some things better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, we scrape, therefore we need a scraper.
Mm-hmm.
We slash, therefore we need a slasher.
Mm-hmm.
And these verbs were translated in their functions became objects.
Okay, it's a good point. What happens in this type of thing is you get the co-evolution of language and objects. In other words, as your objects develop language, your language develops objects, and you get this kind of oscillation between language and objects.
So by developing a hyperdimensional object or language, can we force the development of the others?
I wouldn't say you would force it. It would come.
Yes, but it is in fact the same enterprise. The evolution of a hyperdimensional language is nothing less than the project to create a hyperdimensional object, and vice versa.
In a sense, I would say so. If you get these incredible, you know, psychedelic vision that you have, and you're able, you know, and you call that a transcendental object, then the idea is you will begin to get a hyperdimensional language to begin to make that communicable, or else it stays at that. That's what I mean by bringing it back. By bringing it back, all I mean is by making it communicable so that it is useful to other people. I don't mean to bring it back and stick it in a zoo and say, this is a hyperdimensional object from the Amazon and it's one from Africa. It's got to have functional, useful evolution. It's what I call, it has to have a potential, what I call an evolutionary next message quality to it. It really has to have that quality to it. It's not just object for the sake of object.
But then words which are beheld are much closer to being things than words which are merely heard, because like things, they are seen. So there's a migration toward a single translinguistic, if you will, state where objects and words are suddenly found to be the same thing. And this would be the entry out of history and into a magical dimension where words and things are seen
okay,
to
now,
be the same.
This is it. This is dream time. This is this total participation mystic. This is like in many, for example, the American Indian traditions, they talked about there was a time when men could become animals and animals could become men. And there was one language that was common to all beings. This is the time when this, you can hyperdimensional, translinguistic, whatever you want to call it, there was one language, and there you could go from species, the idea of what we have of the Nagual, of a shaman going to one animal, I think was much more common in ancient times, but I think...
So this is the realm of the extended mind.
That's right.
In the extended mind, words and things are two sides of the same coin.
Yes, and at the highest level of it,
yes,
the very highest level, in the beginning was the word, yeah, and then everything proceeded from that point. And I think there is. And in magic is based on the idea that you can, by intense visualization, you can create an object. I mean, I just say this as an anecdote. I was once doing a test with a biofeedback with this friend of mine, Jeff Blundell, in England, and he had this thing all hooked up to him, and we were sitting around about 15 of us, and he said, "I want you to put this coin under one of the books in front of you in a circular table, and somehow I'll be able to sense when I'm at the place, and the lights will go on in this machine, the mind mirror, and all of that kind of." And he found it 4 out of 4 times where the coin was when he just went by. And then I said to myself, "Hey, okay, enough of that." And I said, "I don't have the coin, but I'm going to create a virtual object underneath my book. I'm going to visualize the bloody coin." And so I did. I put the coin, and he went by me, and his bells went off, and he says, "You've got the coin." I said, "No way." And he said, "I know you've got the coin." I said, "No way." And he said, "Let's look under the book." And he said, "What?" And I said, "What did you do?" I said, "I just placed a virtual object under there." And that was just an illustration of was just magic. Simple. It's not magic. It's just the power of the extended mind. You can just actually place something by intention and attention in the environment that will have that effect.
But it really is magic.
Well, it is in a sense. Yeah. Yeah, please.
To what degree is science and the scientific paradigm just a creation of this hyper meta space, and that the creation of, let's say, DNA first as a thought system, and then as a creation of something that's manipulated, and then its genetic structure, and then we can, given that information, have the ability to hang out in our genetic structure as the metaphor of our extended mind, like you were talking last night, our genetic structure going back and our genetic structure going forward. This is historical access of a group mind phenomena at the scientific base.
So where's the nub of your question?
How does this sort of mirror what the alternative experience that you're talking about in terms of the border crossings around going into, let's say, plant or animal phenomena?
Yeah.
is entering a kind of world experienced enough yet to know that. The science is, let's say, on this level of the ladder, and we can start accessing each other genetically across the room, but we just haven't figured out that's how we're doing it.
Well, what I'd first say is what Terrence said before. We've done all that in the past, in our genetic past. We've been able to go into plants and animals and rocks and the entire, that's what the dream time is all about, the animated earth. It's not just that the earth was alive. It's just that we animated it by our interaction with it. It's not just this being, the earth hanging out. It's what, to really get into it, it's what we call the development of the geopsyche. That's different than the Gaia field, which is the mind and the being of the planet itself. But the geopsyche is the interaction of the collective mind of humanity or of a tribe with the Gaia field. And that's when you begin to get the most interesting hybrid going on. And I think what science has done, at a certain level, science is, as Rupert has said, is and we are really an object-based science. We don't look at so much. We don't look so much at the invisible nature of things in terms of this arising and dissolving kind of dissipative paradigm. And I think that until we get a science which incorporates the object world, you don't want to dismiss that, but as well as to see the magic, this magical element. What, in other words, you see, like Fridtjof Capra developed the new physics, or they won't say developed, made it popular, and Rupert the new biology. And what each of these guys has done, as I see it, is add the dimension of mind too, a classical scientific discipline. And I, in my own sense, I'm an archaeologist, and what I've tried to do is add the dimension of mind to archaeology. So essentially what we're doing is we're restoring a dimension that was written out of the program, but it was always there in the earliest of times. And as again, what Rupert says, I mean, I have to, you know, listen to, is the idea, yes, this object proliferation is part of history. It's not a negative thing. There's tremendous diversity. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with object proliferation. I'm just saying that when we become attached to the objects, that our minds become attached to them and create this unconscious kind of mental virus, as it were, and we become fixated at that level. But there are the phases. There's the time for object proliferation, and there's the time for it. You see, in music, for example, there's a thing, something I'll never forget, of a musician, John Cage, who used to play what he called a prepared piano. You take a piano and you stick shoes in it and small alligators and marbles, and you get all these weird sounds when you play the piano. Now, one of the things that he said about it, and this is a general systems principle, he said, after in talking about atonal music, you know, that's that kind of Schoenbergian kind of, you know, non-rhythmical stuff, he says, at a certain point, spontaneity begins to neutralize itself. And this is so important in composition and evolution. At a certain point, what may be very good for a time actually becomes detrimental to a system. Cancer, for example, is something which is, you know, you have a spontaneous movement, but then it's out of control. You get positive feedback and you're gone. You have to have these kind of governor, these oscillations of kind of, like Rupert said, of some degree of habit, which is positive habit and positive action, and then you have free flow, and then some habit comes back. There's this oscillation. To me, the biggest lesson I've learned in all of this stuff is the oscillation between form and emptiness, and then to know that they are ultimately the same thing. But you have to understand between memory and non-memory is a dance, and between object and objectlessness is also a kind of a dance. Let me just before... Is there anyone else who hasn't said anything that might want to add anything?
I just wanted to ask, and the novelty wave.
Well,
the evolutionary thrust.
Well, I'll say a little bit, and then Terrence can, go on. How would you define? I'll get to write a bit in one, in like a sentence, how would you define novelty wave so everyone knows what we're talking about?
Following Rupert's formulation, I think I would call it the ebb and flow of the interaction between habit and novelty.
Okay. So in a sense, you see, this is very much the same thing between the ebb and flow between habit. Now, it's what I call the oscillation between memory and non-memory. You see, memory is habit-based, it's conservation-based, and non-memory is, and even Saraha says this is where creativity emerges from. So, in a sense, the relationship between intention and the novelty ways, it's a good question, is that, you see, intention decides the point where you will shift from one state to another, from memory to non-memory. Now, the way I look at this, for example, is in meditation practice, for example, if I'm sitting and you take a tennis ball and you throw it up, and the first bounce, right at the very top of the bounce, there's a point in mathematics, it's dx by dt, the rate of change equals zero. It's just that point right there where it's at the height of the bounce. That, and then it bounces again and a little lower, and it reaches that point again and again and again. Now, the point is, each one of those points, when they occur in consciousness, when dx by the rate of change equals zero, is the optimum time to shift gears. That's the time where, if I'm doing a sitting practice and I'm focused into one-pointedness, there's a certain point where one-pointedness becomes difficult to hold. It starts to wander around the edges. So what I've learned to do is, right at that point, I shift into no-pointedness. I give it rein. And that there's a certain point where no-pointedness begins to get too diffuse. And at that point, when the ball is again, you go back into the one-pointedness. And you have to learn those points of where that ultimate optimum rate of change is, where to shift,
But to go with the shift, don't do it against it. Say, no, I'm doing a one-pointed sitting and I'm going to do that, and by God, I'm going to torture myself. I have found for me that's not the way. I'm like this, and when it begins to go, I'll go like that. And then when that weakens, I go like this. And that way, you see, it's the transition from one state to another actually awaken intention and awaken you. They when you go from one state to another, it awakens you. And one last point to this about the intention is that I've said before the cycle is intention, attention, retention. Actually, behind that intention is another memory. And it is a memory, it's this holistic system memory. It's the one that knows the whole show. In other words, there is something behind that. Because to intend something, you say, okay, I want this to really be focused. You have to have an idea, an image of what focused is. And you don't know where you get that from. And you get that from some holistic base, which is even before the intention. Okay, any other points that people want to raise, or just before we go have lunch, or comments or anything?
I just briefly wanted to raise something about the thought, because we talked about the fact with Terence that to some extent objects and their names are the same. But the interesting thing, and of course in Hindu systems you get this hyphenated word, nama rupa, you know, where the name and the form are somehow equivalent. But the interesting thing is that so many forms don't have names. As you say, when venturing through these realms, one's in the realm of the unspeakable much of the time. Forms without names. And to bring them back, they have to be named. And however many you name, there's millions more that won't be named. And it will pass away perhaps forever. And I think that it just occurred to me, we have very much this as a living reality in the world today with the conservation thing. The Amazon jungle is full of species of insects and plants that have never been named. In other words, they're unknown to science, to use the conventional phrase. When they're named, it's announced in the taxonomic journals as a new species to science. In other words, they're not known until they're named. And what's exercising a lot of people at the moment is that a lot of these species are going to become extinct before they're known. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think it's not so bad if they become extinct after they've been known. So you send in a collecting trip, and so you can name them all and have them all in queue herbarium, pressed on sheets and somehow recorded and photographed. And then at least you've done that, even if they become extinct. But somehow the idea that they could just pass away without being named is an actual reality of the world at the moment. Not just in the psychedelic realms, but there are lots of unspeakable plants, in the sense unnameable plants at the moment, because nobody's been there to name them yet. So although in a sense some things become part of our mental world through being names and forms, the psychedelic experience and the Amazonian jungle and lots of other things show us that there are many forms without names. Clouds are another example. We don't even bother to look at most of them because they have forms, they sometimes remind us of things, but usually we just assume these are unnameable forms.
In this model, everything arises out of this. This emptiness, primordial mind, is infinitely spewing out new names and forms. And I don't think you can ever. You say millions of them. You may never be lost forever. I don't think they're lost forever. Any time you tap that dream time, that primordial mind, nothing ever truly ever disappears from that realm. It's there. It's contactable by the state that you put yourself into to access it.
You think that it's so vast that you can never be sure that you'll pass precisely that place.
It doesn't matter. All you can really say is that if you were given the opportunity to, as it were, to imprint and bring it back, and it didn't come back with you, it wasn't right for it. I mean, it didn't have its communicability, was not for that purpose. I wouldn't worry about that element. Where that came from...
Well, but I think artists are the people who do worry about that, who keep trying to go into it and bring out as much as they can and feel the tension. They want to speak the unspeakable. They want to sculpt the mm-hmm. unsculptable, paint the unpaintable. And every time they succeed, a step forward is taken.
It is, but just to round things kind of finally off, it's like what we were just saying the other day about tribal art and canonical art, like the Tonkas and things like that. You see, for them, everything was accessible through
certain canons and frames of reference and geometry and form, because it would awaken within you the new states. What we're saying on this other level, the artist stuff, that it is this pursuit of a novelty wave, like, if I don't get it, it's gone forever. And it's very different from the traditional ways of canonical art, being able to arise in the mind something. And in surrealism, when it arose in the early part of this century, the surrealist artists and painters and poets, what they were all into, when they started getting and smoking hash and hanging out in cafes and absinthe and all of that kind of stuff, what they really got into was the idea that we can pull out images that no one has ever gotten before, and the Dalis and all those kind of people, Magritte, etc. But what, after a couple of years, I did a study of this, what they found disappointed them profoundly, because the further they went out into the unknown to get back the unsculptable and the unpaintable, they found that archetypes of patterns were coming up that, as far as they went to become individualized, they kept on hitting archetypes. As far as they went. And that's what, see, all these artists who want to be individual, the unpaintable and sculptable, they'll come up against this.
Surely the whole point is that if you have habit, you have novelty. And yet the extreme of novelty is habit.
In a sense, and what you want to do, though, as we said before, is to have a balance between the best of habit and the best of novelty. That's really, that's what the novelty wave, this ebb and flow of the two, and between memory and non-memory. You need that, the yin and the yang, to continually redefine each other, to keep each other, to awaken each other.
Yes, yeah. Well, or the role of ego, intention, as opposed to the novelty wave, and it seems to me it's a situation like the old saying in Protestant hermeneutics, man proposes, God disposes. Intentionality is the act of proposing. The novelty wave disposes of the intention in whatever way that it can at that moment.
And that's it. This is KPFK Los Angeles, and we've heard the end of John Steele speaking on memory, a discussion with Terence McKenna, Rupert Sheldrake, and Jill Peirce, who is Mrs. Rupert Sheldrake. I should say Jill Peirce and Rupert Sheldrake, who is Mr. Jill Peirce.